You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Welcome, citizens, to this day in history with Benjamin J. Goldson.
Yes, this day in history, back for another week after a hiatus last time. This week we're looking at the election of Nelson Mandela in 1994 to the presidency of the Republic of South Africa. South Africa having been a part of the sort of British Empire until it declared independence in 1960. And it's interesting because most of the sort of independence movements of the time we associate with a sort of maybe left or sort of anti-racist decolonial movement. But in the case of South Africa, they actually left the British Empire because they wouldn't be allowed to implement the system of racial segregation, which is commonly known as apartheid. So instead they had this big referendum and went independent.
Among the party seeing the Prime Minister off at London Airport was the daughter of the Ghana High Commissioner. This was the beginning of a tour, which may be a milestone in the history of Africa. A statesmanlike undertaking characteristic of Mr. Macmillan. The good wishes of all Britain are with him every minute he is away. During his five-week, 15,000-mile African tour, the Premier will begin by visiting Ghana and Nigeria. Accra, capital of Ghana, went wild with joy when Dr. Nkrumah was released from political imprisonment in 1951. His enthusiastic followers had elected him to power. The independence of the former Gold Coast colony was thereby assured. A born leader, Dr. Nkrumah dreams of a united Africa with himself its chief ruler. Nigeria, home of 36 million people producing tin, coal and other minerals, will present the earth with very different scenes. Mainly, however, the Federation of Nigeria is agricultural. Groundnuts are one of its biggest crops. In this country, it's a highly profitable crop. So too is the production of palm oil, with palm kernels, cocoa and maize, helping to form the wealth economy of this vast land. Federation of Rhodesia and Nyasaland, Mr. Macmillan will encounter a quite different political climate. His airliner may disturb wild animals in the natural reserves. Rhodesia is under white government. The world-famous Victoria Falls still awe the tourist, who recalls amidst that spectacle that only 104 years ago they were first beheld by a white man, the explorer missionary Dr. Livingstone. But it is upon the capital, Salisbury, that the outside world turns critical attention today. For in the Federation, coloured people outnumber Europeans 30 to 1. Yet when the Governor-General, Lord Llewellyn, opened the first federal parliament in 1904, it was essentially a Westminster-type ceremony. And in the copper mines of Northern Rhodesia, third largest producer in the world, the rule is white administration, coloured labour. The same combination constructed the far-famed Kariba Dam. The Federation Premier, Sir Roy Walensky, is in no hurry to change the existing balance between white and coloured races, claiming that in Rhodesia, it is a good, workable arrangement. The protectorates of Basutoland, Bechuanaland and Swaziland will be visited when Mr. Macmillan goes to South Africa. Tribal chiefs have been admitted to local governmental authority in Basutoland, and documents of appointment were given to each in a briefcase. Each one felt halfway to being a civil servant. Links with the not distant past, when the coloured man owned Africa, are still treasured outside towns. And the Union of South Africa never forgets that black men outnumber whites 4 to 1. Fear that the coloured men may one day overwhelm the white is at the back of the South African government's segregation policy. Johannesburg, with a population of more than a million, is a magnificent city. Gold mine workings, visible on the outskirts, remind old-timers that the discovery of the precious metal only 74 years ago was the foundation of Joburg's wealth. But even here, the existence of the Black Sash movement protesting against government policy, shows that many white South Africans agree with Anglican Father Huddleston in fighting segregation. Huddleston was brought back to England by his order. His work goes marching on. So in 1960, Table Mountain looks down upon an unhappy situation. The Union is in the British Commonwealth. In outlook, it is often poles apart. No one nowadays can call at the home of General Smuts. His wisdom went with him to the grave. Nor can Macmillan, in a brief visit, provide a substitute. But he is an unusual man, and the African millions, increasingly aware of this day and age, may come to bless Macmillan's name. So in that continent may all the great peoples that owe allegiance to the Crown.
All right, and so after this referendum, South Africa would vote to go independent. I should say the white minority voted to go independent, which they would stay. And despite sort of splitting from the British Empire, they stayed fairly close in the sort of anti-Soviet bloc with the United Kingdom and America. But still, of course, you had a lot of opposition to the apartheid policies, especially in the country itself, but sort of worldwide. And the sort of figure that became most associated with the anti-apartheid movement, well, that's the Dutch language, Laura, it's very hard to speak, was Nelson Mandela, who I think we're all familiar with. He joined the African National Congress and then sort of founded this sort of, it was a sort of armed group, but they focused far much more on sort of sabotage and, you know, not blowing people up is pretty much what they did. Then he gets thrown in jail for decades, but he was finally released in 1990.
Good evening. For 27 years, 6 months and 6 days, he had been a prisoner. During that time, he became a legend, a symbol of black resistance to apartheid, and to many, he became a martyr. Tonight, he is a free man. Nelson Mandela, the leader of the African National Congress, he walked out of a prison on a gloriously sunny South African afternoon, and there is general agreement that his freedom begins a new era in South Africa. This is a special edition of Sunday Report. We're taking the time, usually filled by Venture, to bring you comprehensive coverage of a truly extraordinary day. A day so many have waited for so long. The day Nelson Mandela was freed from prison. We start with the CBC's Jean-François Lepine.
There's Mr. Mandela, Mr. Nelson Mandela, a free man taking his first steps into a new South Africa.
Nelson Mandela emerged from his long nightmare as a simple man walking his way to freedom accompanied by his wife, Winnie. But his release meant probably more to the whole world than to the man himself. In an unprecedented move, state-controlled television beamed Mandela's release live into the homes of millions of South Africans. Outside, crowds of supporters had waited hours for that very first glimpse of the man that most of them had never even seen before. Mandela was then driven to a huge rally that had been building up since early morning to welcome him.
More than a quarter of a million people came here in the center of Cape Town, hoping to hear Mandela's first public address. At one point, the crowd was so dense and the security so inadequate that Mandela's motorcade couldn't make its way through.
Organizers spent hours trying to control the situation, but it only led to further unrest. As groups of people began to leave the rally, riots and looting broke out in the streets, and South African police forces reacted in panic, shooting almost indiscriminately. Dozens of people were wounded. Journalists were also hit. As the violence went on, Nelson Mandela finally showed up at the rally.
So with Nelson Mandela out of prison, he was free to take up the leadership of the African National Congress Party, which would take part in the election of 1994.
This is the CBS Evening News. Good evening, I'm Deborah Norville reporting. The final weekend of campaigning before South Africa's first open election was interrupted by a deadly car bombing in Johannesburg. At least 9 people were killed and nearly 100 injured. Though unnerved by the blast, officials promise the voting will begin as scheduled on Tuesday. Alan Pizzi reports.
The blast came without warning. It shattered lives and hopes that this week's historic vote would be peaceful.
Get the ambulance.
Police estimated that nearly 200 pounds of explosives were placed in or under a car parked between two key offices of the African National Congress.
Everything just shattered, windows, doors, everything.
An ANC official was among the dead. The bomb was described as the biggest ever used in Johannesburg, and police feared there could be others.
Move back, please. Lost it, move back, sir, please.
As police forensic experts sifted the debris for clues, both the right wing and the Zulu-based Inkatha party denied any connection to the act of terror. The ANC blamed enemies of the democratic process, but vowed it would not stop the elections.
The best way to deal with this kind of political thuggery is to make sure that democracy wins against intimidation and violence.
This was the final day of campaigning before voting begins on Tuesday. Volleys of gunfire punctuated the start of the Inkatha rally and killed at least one person. Zulu chief Mangosuthu Buthelezi urged his supporters to avoid violence and deplored the bombing.
And one can only hope and pray that that is an isolated incident and that we're not going to see an escalation of that kind of violence.
An estimated 100,000 people turned out to hear Nelson Mandela promise that the ANC had a plan to end the violence. And he had a warning for the bombers.
Nothing they can do which will stop us from making the 27th of April a historic day in this country.
The devastated streets of central Johannesburg may be sealed off until after elections. The bomb blast will add to the tension and security fears for the coming week, putting even more pressure on the already overstretched security forces to guard voters, polling booths, and especially political leaders. While no one has claimed responsibility for the outrage, the intent was clear: to wreck any chance of a peaceful end to 340 years of white rule here. Alan Pizzi, CBS News, Johannesburg.
Yes, and Nelson Mandela would win a resounding victory in the South African election of 1994. On this day,
just after dawn in Soweto, blacks on their way to vote for the first time. This first day of voting is set aside for the elderly, infirm, pregnant women, prisoners, and South Africans overseas. The moment is lost on no one.
It's a big day because now we are going to be free. Each and everybody is going to be free.
I feel just like when I was born by my mother. Now I can retire to heaven.
Today is a day like no other before it.
With just over 50% of the ballots counted, there is now no doubt that South Africa is in transition to black majority rule.
Nelson Mandela led his supporters in singing the new national anthem, God Bless Africa.
Free at last.
Mandela, the former political prisoner, had achieved a lifelong dream of a non-racial democratic nation. State President F.W. de Klerk conceded defeat and the end of white minority rule.
I shall be surrendering power, not to the majority of the moment, but to the South African people.
Mandela's National African Party will now meet in the assembly on Friday. They are certain to elect him the next president of South Africa.
I, Nelson Rolihlahla Mandela, do hereby swear to be faithful to the Republic of South Africa.
Once a political prisoner of the state, Mandela is now head of state, completing a remarkable transformation. Representatives from more than 200 governments attended the ceremony. Vice President Al Gore led the U.S. delegation, which included First Lady Hillary Clinton. Cuba's leader, Fidel Castro, was seated a discreet distance away. Protected by a screen of bulletproof glass, Mandela said it is time to heal the wounds of apartheid. To show that he means it, Mandela linked hands with his white vice president, F.W. de Klerk, the man who once upheld apartheid and then helped to dismantle it.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.